You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up, and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week and silly things that people said about sports. I'm Chadwick Matlin, editor at 538. With me in the studio, Neil Payne, a man who says no silly things about sports. Hello, Neil.
Never. Can't imagine saying something silly about sports.
And on the other line, from, quote, somewhere down south, Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Chad. Hi, Neil.
Hey.
How you doing down there?
Things are good. It's warm down here.
I hear that that's a feature of the American South compared to our drizzly...
Yep. Hot take.
Yeah, exactly. Supported by climatological data, though. all right. We, on today's show, we three things, as ever, and then Sig Dig. The first, we are only a month away from Selection Sunday and Monday in NCAA basketball, which means it's that time of year when we mention KenPom ratings at least a half a dozen times a show. We'll check in on what's happening in men's and women's college basketball. Is the parity in the men's game a code word for bad basketball? And can anyone take down UConn in the women's game? We will discuss. Then we'll talk about the NBA All-Star Game, which ended in a 196-173 victory for the West. That is not a typo. Despite that score, Neil thinks that NBA All-Star games are usually defensive showcases. He will try and convince us and also convince us to care about statistical analysis of the NBA All-Star game. Neil, the gauntlet is thrown. And then third, Mike Trout is the best player in baseball, which is why a bunch of people think that the Angels should trade him. We'll marshal the evidence on both sides of the debate about what the Angels should do with their bad farm system and great player and figure out whether Trout is worth more to the Angels in uniform or shipped out of town. And then Alex McCann, allegedly from somewhere in South America, will be calling in for the significant digit.
Even further south.
Even further south, yes. I wonder how warm it is there. There's that whole equator thing that gets in the way, though. All right. You guys ready for some NCAA? We're only a month out, guys, from the tournament. The tournament, if you'll remember, the tournament was Hot Takedown's origin story.
Very true, yeah.
A year ago, we were all sitting around. That was our debut. I'm very excited to reach that one-year anniversary.
And the takes have only gotten hotter since.
That's right. It's global take warming. The perception of the two number one teams in NCAA basketball could not be more different. On the women's side, you have a four-year monolith that no one can touch. And on the men's side, a Villanova team that few seem to believe in. That's indicative of the differences between the two leagues this year. In the women's game, it's UConn and everybody else again. And in the men's game, the field is wide open. So let's take one league at a time, I think, and discuss each league's parity. And we'll do the women's league without a take. As usual, we went looking for a take, and there just aren't a lot of people, unfortunately, talking about the women's game, let alone talking about it with limited
heatedly
information. Yeah. I feel like we have a similar conversation all the time. Is the women's league as simple as it looks on its face, which is that there's a really good team, and then there's not that many good teams beneath them? Or is it just that Connecticut is so... Or is it that Connecticut's so much better and these other teams are actually quite good as well? Do we have any sense for that from either of you?
Yeah, I'll jump in with the statistical angle on it because I think it was in mid-December we sort of checked in slash, you know, previewed the women's season and talked about UConn and how, you know, they looked like they had a really great team, but maybe not as good as in 2014 or 2015. And that was before, you know, they've rattled off, I think they were 7-0 at the time. They're now 24-0. They've beaten most of the other, you know, good teams that are in the mix also, you know, a South Carolina team that seemed like, you know, it was undefeated and might be able to contend with them. Not really. And so now, checking in these months later, we find that this UConn team, using like a statistical power rating. Jeff Sagarin from USA Today, since he's one of the only people that kind of crunches the numbers for women's basketball, this UConn team is only really a hair below the 2015 team. And since the data set that I have, which starts in 2012, so it's not a huge sample, but just looking at those years, and that includes some Brittany Griner, Baylor years, this looks like the second best team in that mix, this UConn team. And it has the biggest gap between the number one team and the number two team. In this case, this year's number two is Notre Dame, and this particular Sagarin rating system thinks that UConn would be favored against Notre Dame by about 15.5 points at a neutral location like the kind that you would find in the NCAA tournament. And, you know, that's not always the way it plays out when they actually do play in a tournament situation, but it's the biggest gap of the past few years that we could see in terms of having that second team kind of rivaling UConn. But maybe there is also hope, because if you look at the top 25 overall, and we'll do the same thing in a few minutes for the men's side, this is the most compressed of all the teams in the top 25 in that sample that I have. So UConn is way out in front of the pack, but in numbers 2 through 25, I think you do see more balance between the rest of the teams than you see in a typical year recently. So I don't know if that just means that there's a lot of candidates to duke it out for a clear second place far behind UConn, or if that might, you know, make the tournament more exciting than it had been in the past.
Yeah, I think in past years, the one thing that the women's tournament had going for it was the fact that Notre Dame, even if statistically when you crunch the numbers, maybe shouldn't have been in the same conversation as UConn. They had, and again, you can't put a statistic on this, but over the years, over the last 5 years, Notre Dame had played UConn so, so well and actually beaten UConn in some key games that you ended up believing that Notre Dame had the belief in itself that they could compete with UConn, even if you went into a matchup between the two being like, okay, well, all of the data, the limited data we have in women's sports says this isn't possible, but hey, guess what? Notre Dame is the one program that I think could do this. And I think, to me, sometimes, and we can't put a number on it, but the biggest gap in women's college basketball is this like kind of inflated difference that UConn puts between itself and its next best competitors, talent-wise, recruiting-wise, practice-wise, style-wise, and then that gets inflated to like the nth degree, because then there's also like this emotional and mental edge that they have built in because they've been doing it for so many years and so few programs have been able to even step on the court with them and believe that they can win.
Yeah, Kate, I think we've talked about that before. I think, were you telling me the story about playing against UConn players at a summer clinic or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
And the mental weight of playing against UConn when you were playing college basketball. And it does seem to me as though this is an area where the numbers maybe can't do the full thing justice when you're playing against a team that is this good. And, you know, you hear all the time that teams are coming to play against someone and giving them their best shot, right? Because they're trying to take down the giant killer.
The bullseye.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, bullseye on the back. And here, I mean, the bullseye hasn't left UConn's back for 4 years now, and they've lost one game, and they're lost 109 games.
Yeah, and what I've talked a lot about, like, with some of my friends, because one of my good friends works for SNY, which has the broadcast rights for UConn women's basketball. And we have this conversation all the time because she does the Gino Auriemma show, his weekly show. And the topic is always, well, is UConn good for the women's game, quote unquote? And she maintains the position that, like, all the other programs, however they can do it, need to rise to UConn's level. And while obviously I agree, we don't want women's college basketball and UConn being the premier program to have to get worse in order to have any sort of competitiveness and parity, but there is a larger conversation to have about how the factors at play in women's college basketball are not equivalent to men's college basketball. Like, in men's college basketball, you can have recruits and you can pitch and you can be like, look, we're not Kentucky, but we're on TV 20 times a year, we're on ESPN, got all this money. if you look at women's college basketball, UConn can offer this set of circumstances that really renders a lot of other programs not that competitive when it comes to we promise we'll be on magazine covers, we promise we'll be on TV. So I know right now we're kind of crunching like the power numbers about women's basketball, but if you look long-term about who's going to compete with UConn, it's going to be really tough because they offer things that other programs just cannot offer these star players.
Well, and what's the end goal for the star players? Is it the WNBA? Is it national exposure that eventually gets them endorsement deals when they do get to the WNBA? Like, what from your perspective, what's the calculation that recruits are making?
The calculation, I think, and I think most women's players are aware of this, is that the meat and potatoes of their career, when they're going to be most relevant, is college basketball. I mean, once they get to the WNBA, the spotlight is actually a lot dimmer because of how committed ESPN is to promoting the women's college game and the women's tournament. That spotlight is biggest in college for women's players, which is unlike men's college basketball, obviously. There's a huge spotlight, but you can go play in the NBA, which has an even more massive spotlight. So if they're doing that mental calculation, I think a lot of kids are, they're like, why would I go take some pitch from, you know, South Carolina, which has a great pitch with Dawn Staley and the Gamecocks? Why would I, in these 4 years, which are going to be my main years to be able to have the spotlight, have a guaranteed spotlight in UConn, or I can, quote, unquote, go build a spotlight over here? It's just a very risky proposition that men's basketball players don't have, which I think leads to seeing more parity.
I think next time we talk about UConn, I want us to bring on an economist to talk about like anti-monopoly, antitrust sort of things, and how do you break up a monopoly of this kind? Because there must be some parallel to draw from the idea of one business getting one corporation getting all the business in an industry.
Regulation, Chad. Mm-hmm.
Well, the NCAA is actually overzealous about that. One might
right.
argue. All right. So real quick before we move on to the men's game, Kate, what are we missing by having the same conversation about UConn over and over again in the women's game? What are the storylines that you wish even Hot Takedown would talk about more, or alternatively, sort of what is a different way of viewing UConn than this conversation about whether they're good or bad for the game?
I think we're honestly, this level of the conversation underneath, are they good for the women's game, like, needs to be had, because within it you kind of expose the different varying like economic factors and media factors that play into like the annual perpetuation of UConn as this consistent dominant team. Now, we talk ad nauseum about their skill on the court and their, like, Neil rattling off like their dominance when you come to like the statistical analysis. Like, it actually needs, people need on like a basic level to kind of see how, because it's the women's game and there's only one program that can offer these certain like exposure factors, how that plays into then a lack of parity, which then leads to people turning off games. I mean, if you look at UConn and you really unpack everything about it, underneath that, are they good for the women's game? There's like a lot of branch off conversations that are pretty interesting. Mm-hmm.
And I do wonder if this is kind of represents an opportunity if they can crack the code, if it just means that, you know, if the women's game gets more attention and more media coverage, that will unlock the, you know, parity problem and sort of help other teams. Like, it seems like UConn may be at the maximum amount of coverage that they can get right now because they're so dominant, and it's hard to imagine them becoming more dominant also on the court, especially if there are things that level the playing field. So it seems like as more attention gets paid to women's basketball, then perhaps it'll be the next group of teams that really reaps the benefits from that, and then it becomes kind of a virtuous cycle as opposed to sort of the vicious one that you're describing right now, Kate.
Yeah, and it could be that if you look at UConn's origin story, like ESPN actually plays a huge part in it, that they're both Connecticut-based programs, and the way ESPN has always been having UConn in its backyard has always gravitated toward telling their stories. It could be like an inorganic evolution where you could look at like a Maryland program, which is historically good, now have like a company like Under Armour in their backyard that might pump in money to that program and elevate it and have the kind of like, you know, gear, because if you look at the future of Under Armour, it can be like as big as Nike, the same way Nike has has fueled Oregon. I think in some ways it might have to be like this inorganic way where a program just has some sort of infusion, whether it's finances or star players for reasons that you can't replicate, like Brittany Griner going to Baylor, that might tilt and shift women's college basketball as we look into the future.
Interesting. One oligopolistic force maybe creating the oligopoly inside of college basketball.
That's right, Chad. That's exactly right.
I've always wanted to say oligopolistic.
And now we have.
Yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on to the men's league where everyone keeps losing. For the week of February 5th, for the week leading into February 15th, teams ranked in the AP top 25 went 27-23 the week prior, with 16 of those 23 losses coming to unranked foes. That is quite bad to have that many good teams lose, especially to unranked teams. And we have a number one team in Villanova that it seems as though no one in particular really believes in. I feel like partly because of Villanova's history in the NCAA tournament, which I want to talk about, things are not really Villanova's not really trusted to be a real standard bearer for the league. Neil, how does this top 25 shake out when you look at the advanced numbers from our friend Ken Pomeroy at kenpomeroy.net? Or is it kenpom.net? I always forget.
I believe it is kenpom.com.
.com. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Had the wrong suffix on there. Is this league as bad as it seems?
Yeah, I think by the numbers, by Ken Pomeroy's power rating, which is sort of like the Sagarin one that we talked about before, and a lot of people will use that to fill out their brackets in about a month. This is a pretty weak team to be leading the pack. They're number one in Ken Pom's rating, in addition to being number one in the polls. But at the same time, if they finish the season with the rating that they have right now, they would be the worst number one Ken Pom team since 2006 and the second worst since 2002, which was when Ken Pom started doing this. The only team that would have been worse was the 06 Duke team in terms of their power rating. And this is number one in the country, so everyone else by definition is worse than that. And it really does set up like this narrative of a lack of a dominant team. And I think for Villanova, it's also, you know, it doesn't help things that they haven't played a particularly tough schedule. I think, you know, playing in the Big East, not the Big East of old, this current version and configuration of it. And, you know, the other teams below them just sort of seem to also not really be all that special. And we've had other teams sort of occupy that top spot throughout the year also, like Iowa at one point. And those teams really have not impressed. And it may just be one of those years in which there is not a dominant force.
And it feels like the best case scenario for men's college basketball is that there are these powerhouse teams that have this great talent and play great basketball, and then, you know, the equivalent that shows up on the Ken Pom ratings as like these great teams, and there's a lot of them. Like, best case would be about like a few that are super strong and so fun to watch, but then there's also beneath that like a slew of teams that are playing such good basketball as to on any given night be competitive with the best teams. But in lieu of that, which is what would be tough to say happens that frequently in men's college basketball, in lieu of that, like, I think I would rather see basketball that, while maybe not having the numerous teams that are like powerhouse teams, I would rather see like 10 to 15 teams that are losing as the number one. Like, we've seen all year long all these programs where like you can flip on the TV and watch college basketball and maybe you could kind of decipher, all right, we're not seeing the tip-top quality that we saw when we were watching Wisconsin or Kentucky last year, but at the end of game, like, there's going to be a lot of really close games. I would rather see that than like one dominant team.
Yeah, and it's worth saying that if we do the same kind of like looking at the standard deviation of ratings for the top 25 that we did for the women's game, this is the most compressed group of top 25 KenPom teams since 2002, so since he started tracking it. So that also kind of speaks to what you were saying, is that, you know, there may not be a team breaking away from the pack, but all of the teams in the top 25 are pretty good and they're pretty close to each other, so that may manifest itself in really exciting basketball in the tournament.
So I want to This brings to mind the conversation. This brings to mind the take that I want to play around whether parity is good for college basketball or not. Here's Brandon Tierney on CBS saying that parity is bad for college basketball.
All right, March is going to be an absolutely nutty month. And here's a question for you, and that's whether or not people really truly enjoy parody when it comes to the to March Madness and the big dance. And I got to tell you, the more I think about this, the answer is no. The problem is when you have a team, quote-unquote, come from nowhere, when they get to that point, you run the risk of a real dud in the national semifinal. And I think if you look at some of the teams this year, see, there's something to be said for the blue bloods, you know, the Dukes, the Carolinas, Kentuckys, Michigan State. People want to see them threaten to lose. But at the end of the day, I don't think a lot of people want to actually see them lose, because what happens, you might get theater in the Final Four, but it's largely anonymous. When you get anonymous players and teams that you don't know, and I don't mean to sound rude, but it's almost like watching a high school game. What is the real difference outside of the fact that it's on TV?
So anytime a sports person says, I got to tell you, you know that you're
what you're about
up
to hear is a hot take.
Yeah. So, you know, I don't have the ratings numbers in front of me, but it seems to me that when George Mason makes the Final Four, or when we have these Cinderella teams, when Wichita State makes the Elite Eight, whatever else, the power of March Madness is that stories and narratives are created in those few weeks, and not many people who are tuned into March Madness are watching college basketball all the way throughout the year. And so there is a hard it's a unique sport compared to others in men's college basketball, because there is a hard reboot as far as narratives and stories for people who are coming late to the game, come to the playoffs. And so I'm not sold on this idea that parody is bad, even if the game quality may be worse.
And it's also worth saying that our boss, Nate Silver, he's been doing March Madness projections for a long time. And he, one of the first things that he found was that a team's preseason rating, with no regard to how it actually performed in the season, was a pretty good predictor of how it would do in the tournament. Obviously, how a team ends up playing is also an important factor. But a lot of the teams in the preseason ratings end up either being teams that are those blue bloods, and so you can expect those types of teams to maybe outperform expectations just if you looked at the season. And then also, you know, teams that had a good recruiting class, and maybe one of the reasons why we're seeing so much parity this year can be traced back to just recruiting last year. Like, the, you know, you had Kentucky, they were only number two. Perennially, they tend to be number one. And then you had teams like LSU, California, Texas A&M. These are not, like, you know, great teams, or at least haven't been over the past couple of years. And they landed big recruits and great recruiting classes. So if you kind of trace it back to that, it still means that you're seeing really hyped freshmen, even if they're wearing a uniform that our commentary guy just then might consider the wrong uniform. The talent is in the place, you know, where it actually manifested itself in this parody.
And he seems to be projecting some sort of extreme version of parody, which actually, if you're playing out kind of what he's saying, lands us with a Final Four where there's like four underdogs almost. Like, we'd have like a George Mason versus a Butler, and two teams where, in the same way as, you know, a NBA Finals, you kind of want these like bigger markets to anchor why people would care around the country. I don't think in an extreme form of any March Madness, like whether it's seeing all of the favored higher seeded teams winning, I don't think anybody wants any extreme version of March Madness. Just like I don't love seeing a Final Four with all number ones, but because I think the whole point of the Final Four, I mean of March Madness, is to have like this varying like mishmash of upsets that end favorites and all of that. So I think in any extreme form of the tournament playing out, like it's not gonna be exactly what you want, but it's so rare when that happens. And if you got one 8 seed or one 10 seed in the Final Four, I think people enjoy that storyline.
Yeah, and Butler is a good team that I should have mentioned earlier, Kate. Thanks for reminding me of them. Where, you know, that Butler team became a sensation by the time that they went to the finals 2 years in a row.
Second straight.
And the Gordon Hayward shot still gets referred to, and it clinking off the rim. It just seems to me like, and we have to wrap up this segment in a second, and so I'll selfishly take the last word, but it seems to me as though we routinely forget that there are going to be upsets in the first round of the tournament almost every year. That no matter what, for whatever reason, within college basketball, there is always enough parity, it seems, that, you know, a 12 seed will be a 5, et cetera. And there are always those upsets. And so the idea of obsessing about it on the front end is misplaced, because we're going to get the tournament we get, and they're going to have the narratives that the tournament has.
We get the tournament we deserve, not right. The one we need.
All right. Let's move on.
You got the last word.
I know. He's always sneaking that in. Let's move on now to the All-Star game, the NBA All-Star game, where it seemed like the skills competition never ended come the actual game. The West nearly hit 200 points, and the East was not far behind. The guys from the podcast Believe the Hype tell us why the All-Star game was actually quite boring.
There was no defense. It was honestly kind of unwatchable because it was everyone was scoring and no one was even scoring at like historic rates individually. So it was just kind of like, yeah, get to see LeBron get 17 or 13 or whatever the heck he had in the game, and that was kind of it. Like I was not particularly excited by this All-Star game.
It just seemed like everyone was going out of their way to let the other guy score. It was just strange to me.
Just strange, guys. How dare they distribute the point load evenly? If we're
how egalitarian.
If we're going to have a lot of offense, it must come through one. They have to beat Will Chamberlain's record or the game doesn't count, basically. Neil, you were really interested in this All-Star game.
Sort of.
You want to tell us why this All-Star game, why the NBA All-Star game is not the offensive showcase that I always think of it as.
Yeah, so I started out kind of just watching the game on Sunday like everybody else, and like the guys that supplied our take, I don't think it's necessarily really even that hot of a take, because it was atrocious, the defense or the complete lack of effort being shown to stop anyone.
Didn't feel that different.
So I felt like the rep on All-Star games is always that they don't play any defense, and so I was trying to figure out like where does this rank in terms of the least amount of defense ever played in an All-Star game after we take into account who was actually playing. So you would expect, you know, the offensive output, the efficiency, points scored per possession, to be pretty high in an All-Star game anyway, because you have LeBron, you have Kevin Durant, you have really great players out there, and it's just hard to defend those guys. So we can't hold it to the standard, even though they scored, an absurd number of points this year. A, it was done with a lot of possessions. This was one of the higher-paced All-Star games. They played 144 possessions in the game. And then also, you know, with a lot
What's
of talent.
What's an average game usually have?
Average game in the NBA is under 100. Average All-Star game is a little bit more than that over the years. But I would say since the early 80s, the average is about 118. This one was 144. I think that's actually the high of that era, so of the last 30 years. So, you know, if you take away those factors, though, you still find, you know, you can measure on a per-possession basis how well the defenses did against expectation. So I was expecting defense to always be in short supply in the All-Star game. But as it turns out, if you account for who the players are and kind of compare to what an average NBA defensive effort would be in terms of keeping the other team from a certain level of efficiency, defenses actually, over the last 30 years, tend to be above average. They hold teams to below the scoring output that you would expect based on who the players are on the team. And that wasn't the case this year. This year was one of the worst defensive showings, I believe second worst since 1981. So, but it was interesting to me that this phenomenon of really being torched on a per-possession basis above and beyond what you would expect from this group of talent that's assembled is kind of a new phenomenon. It only started around 2011. Between 81 and 2010, there wasn't a five-year period in which the All-Stars didn't actually score less than you would expect based on the talent they have on their team.
Well, I'm wondering, because as we were even talking about this leading up to the podcast, I was like, well, how do we account for, or can we account for, just an all around the lack of like focus and intensity?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, even if you watch them on offense during the NBA All-Star game, like sometimes they're like lobbing up an alley-oop sort of half-heartedly, or they're trying things that the degree of difficulty leads to less high shooting percentages. Like, Neil, do you think that plays in at all to what seems like decent defense is actually just like an overall lack of like in-game focus like that we would see in a regular season or playoff NBA game?
Yeah, I think that's totally also playing into this, where, you know, shot selection on offense could be lazy back in the 90s or before that, and that could manifest itself as scoring less than you would expect based on the players. So for sure, like, you know, screwing around on offense can lead to bad outcomes. And when I dug into it, some of the factors that kind of showed up to me also, you know, they take a lot more threes than they used to. That's just across the NBA in total, and that shows up in the All-Star game. But one of the interesting things to me was that two-point accuracy has exploded in the last 5 years in the All-Star games.
But not necessarily league-wide?
No, not really league-wide. I think it's been pretty constant. But in the All-Star game, it's taken off. They practically never foul in the All-Star game anymore. They never shoot free throws. This one, I think they may have shot like four or five combined free throws. I don't have the number exactly in front of me. They never try to block shots. So basically, they contest nothing at the basket. And also, you know, guys are not doing them the favor of taking mid-range shots, and they're taking it to the basket. And that's a trend going across basketball in general. And they also aren't forcing turnovers anymore in the All-Star game. This was one of the lowest turnover All-Star games ever, or at least in the last 30 years. So all of these things kind of play together where, believe it or not, All-Star games actually used to resemble normal basketball games in terms of the stats that were produced in them. And that just isn't the case anymore. And I think we saw like a super extreme example of that the other day.
So you're saying then a normal All-Star game, given the talent on the court, would end in a score of 140 on each side, or something.
Yeah,
like
something
that.
Like that. Okay. Like, the, you know, these absurd rates of just raw points are a product of them playing an up and down style because they have the best, most skilled players, and they are free to, you know, play a faster paced style in general.
And deeper benches?
And
no?
Deeper benches, yeah. Of course. You know, they play the bench for something like 50% of the game, which you don't really see in the NBA.
Okay. So what you're saying, Neil, is that come next All-Star break, if we want to see basketball at its most pure form, we are rooting for a 140-139 game, right?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's possible that that game still would be boring and wouldn't be exciting. But I think these guys hit the nail on the head when they said a game that's all offense and no one makes any attempt to defend at all, especially, you know, when people are attacking the basket, is just the height of not exciting basketball. It's boring. And I think it's kind of devolved in particular over the last few years into that style of play.
Okay, let's leave it there. All right, on to baseball. You know, people are getting itchy for baseball to begin when a casual parlor game or just an innocent little sentence in a blog post blows up into a full-fledged news item. Last week, Keith Law, ESPN's baseball swami, said the Angels farm system was so bad that they needed to do anything they could to restock it, anything including trading Mike Trout, the best player in baseball. That led to this exchange on ESPN's Around the Horn.
Trade Mike Trout, KB? Can they really be considering this?
I don't think so, and even Keith Law is kind of on the fence about doing it right now. I mean, the problem, look, they just won, what, 98 games just a season ago? So, I mean, why would you do that? They need to shore up their lineup and protect Trout. They need to do some other things, but don't think about getting rid of him.
I mean, if their prospect system doesn't get better in the next year or two, they need to consider this, because in baseball, your best player, the best player, does not impact the game the way it does in basketball. So you can have the best player, but if you don't have a bunch of guys around him that are really good, you're not winning anything. So they might need to consider this in a year or two.
So you would buy the idea of trading Mike Trout in a year's time to restock the farm system? Okay.
If you were going to get a ton of guys, yes.
The Red Sox traded Babe Ruth. How'd that work out? The Mets traded Nolan Ryan. How'd that work out? He's the best player in baseball. You hold on to him, and you do everything you can to figure out a way to build around him. You do not trade Mike Trout.
Oh, that little
sound. You guys.
Kate, that was you.
That was me. That was our longest hot take that we've ever offered people.
So, Kate, you want to give a little background?
Can I explain myself, please?
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if I need to explain myself or I just need to take a bow because I haven't yet heard what Neil might say about this. But I probably should have emailed Neil before going on Around the Horn. But here was my thinking, because we had done that podcast about how players from each sport actually impact winning championships. And I remember from our discussion, baseball is just so far down the list. So my thinking was that having the equivalent of LeBron James, but in baseball, Mike Trout, like if you don't have good talent around him and you don't have like a plethora of options around him, well then what does it matter? Because his actual impact on being able to bring you a championship is really low. I didn't really take my thinking any farther than that, like to look at, you know, war or how valuable farm systems are. Like it was pretty much just that.
Yeah, I think, I hearkened back to that discussion when I heard your hot take also, because that was the first thing that I thought of. And it's definitely true that in baseball, that the best player really doesn't have that much of an impact compared to other sports. But at the same time, if you look at like the hit rate, the batting average, if you will, to mix metaphors, of prospects in baseball, it's really not all that high. The best prospect in like an insane prospect, someone who rates as like the highest prospect grade, according to Fangraphs and some calculations that Jeff Zimmerman did a couple days ago, could only expect to have 25 WAR in their entire careers. And there aren't many guys like that. In fact, I don't know if there's a single person who rates as the highest possible grade or even like kind of a notch below that this year. If we look at Boston, the Red Sox have the best farm system according to Fangraphs this year, and their total WAR of all of their players together in that farm system over the course of their career, we would expect them to put up 63 WAR, and that's pretty par for the course, I think.
That's for the whole system, every player combined.
Every player combined in the whole system for their entire career, if you add up their WAR, their wins above replacement, you'll get 63.
And Mike Trout has already been worth more than that in the few years that he's played, right? Something like 8, what was it? Or maybe he's at 45 or something like that?
He's at 38 now, through age 23, but that's 4 full seasons, and back when we talked about the MVP race and Trout versus Josh Donaldson, who ended up actually winning, we talked about Trout's place in history. He's the highest WAR player through each full age, you know, season that he's played, age 20, age 21, 22, and 23. In the history of baseball, he's been the best player through all of those ages. And if you kind of extrapolate out and look at similar players to him and how they did over the rest of their career, I estimated that the rest of his career would be worth something like 70 to 100 WAR.
That's more than an entire Boston farm system, which is the best farm system in the league.
Right, and the best farm system in baseball tends to be around that like 50-60 WAR mark if you add up all things, and that's come from a couple of different estimations over the years. So you'd almost need like maybe not two full best farm systems in baseball, but like the best farm system and then a chunk of the second best or third best or something, just to kind of make up for Trout's entire rest of his career.
Well, I think my flaw in thinking here was, one, not really processing like what the specific definition of prospects are, because coming from like an NBA background covering the NBA, it was processing more in my mind like, okay, if you trade LeBron James for like 5 or 6 like really like decent major leaguers, you know what I mean? As opposed to trading him for guys whose value is just so fluctuating, like an actual, you know, 17-year-old prospect, because that was the part where, like, I was actually thinking, like, wait, trade Mike Trout for, like, you know, 2 really good pitchers and 3 really good field players, not random 17-year-olds who have possibly a high upside.
Neil, I think you might be wrong. I'm coming to Kate's defense.
Oh,
here.
Look at this.
Okay, so here's the thing.
I don't know how, even though Neil made it clear that, like, every good prospect for the next 40 years still wouldn't equal Mike Trout.
Well, what Neil made clear was that if you took a full farm system, they would mature out to 60 WAR, right? But that ignores a few things, in my opinion, Neil.
Okay.
One is you have to think about championship windows. The Angels are not going to be good right now. So why are they going to hold on to Trout? They're wasting Trout's productive years. Productivity only matters if you can put together a good team around him. And so why not try and recoup something for this lost productivity? That's A.
But the Angels won 85 games last year, just putting that out there.
Absolutely right, but they're going to be even worse this year. B, is there any value to having depth, several good players, as opposed to just one good player? And this gets at what Kate was saying about one player only having so much ability to affect a baseball team, but which is that the Angels got to fill out a lineup, and Mike Trout can only come up one out of every nine times. So is there value, or does WAR just obviate what I'm saying right now?
I believe that there was a story written by myself and Jonah Carey, which you edited.
Oh, good. This is good.
About
right back in my
the best way to build a Major League Baseball team, in which we kind of looked at whether it's better to have a stars and scrubs base for your roster.
Should I edit that?
Or is it better to kind of have this balanced roster? So stars and scrubs would be you have Trout, and then you have a bunch of kind of replacement level or, you know, average players somewhere in that spectrum, but no, like, supporting stars. In a balanced roster, no one is as good as Trout, but no one is really, like, bad either. They're all just kind of, like, good players. And we found that when it comes to sort of, like, predicting how well the team will play over the rest of a season or you know, in future championships also, that it really doesn't matter. What really matters is just a win-above replacement is a win-above replacement. It doesn't matter whether it comes from a bunch of players, which is kind of counterintuitive because you would think that actually by having it tied up all in one player, you're putting a lot of risk that, you know, a guy might get hurt. But then at the other side of the spectrum, there's the idea that, you know, if you do have a lot of your production tied up in one player, then you have more roster flexibility with the players that aren't Mike Trout, and you can kind of slot guys in and out, and you don't have to worry about, you know, this very carefully balanced puzzle that you've put together in which you have no flexibility whatsoever. So that's my thought on why it balances
out. What if I just trade for pitchers? Right, there is some value to having WAR distributed between pitchers and batters, is there not? Because I would need pitchers in order to be able to win games, or if I had enough. Is it just, or is it as simple as WAR is WAR? I refuse to believe WAR can just be WAR.
I'm not totally sure if I've seen a study. I'm sure someone has conducted it. Reach out to us at podcast@538.com and let us know if you've seen one, but about whether it's better to have value tied up in pitching or non-pitching. But it also seems like, you know, there's this old kind of tired but perhaps true phrase in baseball of there's no such thing as a pitching prospect, that we've seen a lot of these guys that in particular as pitchers that make these top prospect lists just burn out, throw out their arms. Pitchers peak incredibly early, that if you're not getting value out of them in their first few years, you're not actually getting their best years. They don't follow, at least not anymore, the kind of normal arc that you would expect of a player like Trout, who gets better until age 28, you know, 27, and then kind of slowly tapers off. So there's arguments to be made about the construction in that case, but I think in general, the thing to think about with prospects is just that, you know, they do have so much variance. So if you do trade, it's like getting lottery tickets in a certain sense. So if you traded Trout and you got a bunch of prospects back, you could, you know, eventually become even better than you would with Trout if you landed on a certain, like a generational crop of talent or whatever. But on average, there's no reason to think that that would be any more likely than having all of those guys go bust and you just made the Babe Ruth trade of the 21st century.
Okay. Well, now the most important question is, Neil, are you embarrassed for me?
No. This is...
You think that there was an okay position, but maybe just not as statistically savvy as it could have been?
Well, I mean, gosh, if you took the low end of Trout's kind of projection, if you would say that, oh, he's only going to produce 70 WAR or whatever, then it actually kind of comes close, like the 63.5 of Boston. If you had like a particular, like we said with Boston, they don't have any of these like true blue chip highest of the high rated prospects. So maybe you would come across a class that actually had one of those guys in addition to a lot of other good players, and you could push a a prospect class north of 70 WAR, and it could be that Trout, you know, gets injured or that he's not as good. The defensive metrics might be overstating his value. So there's enough wiggle room in there that there's, you know, a pretty significant chance that you're right and I'm wrong. But just based on sort of the averages, it looks like it's a little bit better tilted in Trout's favor.
In our simulations, Kate is right 35% of the time, and Neil's right 65% of the time. Sorry, Kate.
Just
enough.
In
okay,
this
yeah,
case,
right.
She's usually
right,
yeah, that
right
is not
65% of the time or more.
All right, and of course, we didn't even talk about what happens if you flip one of those prospects into other prospects. There's a domino effect, but we'll leave that for baseball season to actually start. All right, let's move on to Significant Digit, our weekly installment of a telling number from the world of sports. Allison McCann joins us. Hi, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
Kate Fagan had to run out because she had some story matters to attend to. And Allison, you are also calling in from afar. Where are we talking to you from?
I'm calling from Argentina.
Allison, whoa. That is the most glamorous Significant Digit yet. Why are you in Argentina?
I know I was really hunting for an Argentine sig dig, but there was
nothing
there was
messy.
Like crazy, there was a messy free kick this weekend. That did you guys see this? Where he like passed it to Suarez.
Oh yeah,
instead.
Yeah.
But I feel like Messi on Barcelona doesn't even count as Argentine Significant Digit. Anyway, I'm here mostly for fun. My boyfriend's down here working on some stories, and I came to tag along and maybe do some pre-Olympic scouting. Also was in my pitch to come here, and then a little vacation. So
cool.
Mostly fun.
Excellent. But hot takedown and Significant Digit never sleeps. So what do you have for us?
Never sleep. 206 is this week's Significant Digit. That is the number of shots that Max Hooper, senior guard on Oakland, has taken. And probably the more interesting part of that is also the number of three-pointers that he has made. So he's only taken 206 three-pointers, and all of them, I guess 206 shots, and all of them have been three-pointers is the clearest way to explain this.
Wow.
So no two-pointers.
No two-pointers. He has not taken a shot inside the arc.
And so he hasn't attempted them. Has he said this is purposeful? That, or did he stumble into not ever taking a two?
No. I mean, he said, obviously, like, this is a big part of my role on this team is taking threes. It's not that he's, like, not trying to, but that's sort of what's opened up for him. And that's where his, like, strong suit is. He said they don't really do, like, the I don't know what you call it, where it's like quick and somebody like runs down and does a layup or something. He was like, I would do it then. I'm not going to like stop and like take a three-pointer. But like anytime I'm sort of outside, like that's the shot that I am good at.
So he just happened to never have any kind of layup or anything like that. That's
I had the quote
amazing.
In front of me. He says, I'm shocked that I haven't taken a two, that I haven't stepped on the line or had an open layup, but it's just playing my game.
And is he making a lot of them for all the ones that he's taking?
Let's see. He's this season his.
I have it in front of me. It's 45.8% of his threes.
It's pretty good.
40th best among Division I players.
Isn't this what Ben Morris, our colleague, suggested Steph Curry should basically do? Is just take a three every time.
The trick is that Max Hooper is not exactly Steph Curry.
Well, you never know.
Max, you have something to shoot for.
I know, seriously. I watched some good, like, he has a bunch of, like, YouTube highlight reel channels where he tries to make, like, the, like, most number of three-pointers in 5 minutes that he can, and I think his record is 109 right now, so it's pretty fun to watch him do that as
wow.
well.
Cool.
I would watch him try to make two-pointers. I think that sounds like an even more challenging.
All right, we will put an embed of Max Hooper and those three-point videos on 538. Allison, thanks for bringing us our Significant Digit.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Enjoy.
Bye, Allison.
Bye.
That will do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan in absentia. Neil, as always. Actually, I would say your value above replacement podcaster was what do you think? 0.5? No, yeah, I think you were in the 1+ range today.
I would just like to be in the conversation of the Mike Trout of
in the room
podcasting.
Of the Mike Trouts. Of
right, yeah, like maybe a farm system quality relative to that Trout, who we don't know who it is.
Exactly. Before I launch into the full credit read, some small news, which we'll talk about at the top of the show going forward, which is a live hot takedown. The inaugural live hot takedown
is coming to the world and will be at the Sloan Sports Analytics Conference. There may be no friendlier crowd in the world for a takedown than at Sloan. Neil, have you ever performed live in front of hundreds of adoring fans?
No, before? I'm really worried about, usually they splice my voice together from about 200 different pickups per episode where I mess up. So I'm not sure how they're going to do that live.
We'll retain all the pickups just live. The audience will love it. What if the people bring like your Andrew Wiggins article in person and start like ripping it up?
Oh, that would be amazing. I expected that last year. But maybe you've seen like at all of these college basketball games, like when people are shooting free throws, they wave like the heads of people. I would like to see someone just open challenge to the audience.
Hot takedown
print
fans.
Out a head of us or anyone that you would want and wave it around.
My head blown up that size. That would That's be right. terrifying. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Sorry, I should also say those who are not able to get in Sloan, I'm not sure if you'll be able to attend quite yet, but those who are coming to Sloan, we'd love to see you, meet you, chat a bit before and after. Back to the credits. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast skipper is Jody Avergan. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Tony Chow. Our intern is Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on SoundCloud. Actually, we're not on SoundCloud anymore. Sorry, SoundCloud. It's just Stitcher, just Downcast, just all sorts of other apps that aren't SoundCloud. We're on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show while you're there. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.